This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Personally, I'm tired of this statement that says the opposition is fragmented. We have over, 500,000 churches in Zimbabwe, and you don't hear anyone say the church is fragmented for the simple and good reason that it's not the number of opposition political parties that matters in Zimbabwe. It's what those opposition political parties are able to do.
Zimbabwe politician Tendai Biti talks about the strength of the opposition. Details coming up.
Also, the death toll from the earthquake that shook Tanzania yesterday is now 16. And in Kenya, 11 political parties announced they will merge with President Uhuru Kenyatta's Jubilee Party.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the death toll in Tanzania rose to 16 today as a second tremor of an earthquake shook the northwest of the country and the shores of Lake Victoria. An estimated 250 residents of the Kagera region were injured by the tremors and more than 800 homes were destroyed. The office of President John Magufuli said the government is organizing rescue efforts. The first quake measured 5.7 on the Richter scale and is considered of moderate strength. The last notable quake in the region was in 2004 and measured 4.7.
Kenyan politics got a bit of a shake-up Saturday when 11 political parties officially announced they would merge with President Uhuru Kenyatta's Jubilee Party. The announcement comes with less than 12 months before the presidential election. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig speaks with political analysts about what this means for Kenyan politics.
Tens of thousands of cheering supporters filled a Nairobi sports stadium Saturday as Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto launched their new Jubilee Party with the addition of nearly a dozen other parties. Kenyatta emphasized togetherness as the main reason for the merger, saying the party we launch here today is an expression of our unity, and in launching it, we renew and strengthen our ties that bind Kenyans together. But some analysts believe this announcement was more for show than for substance. University of Nairobi Department of Political Science Chairman Adam Zolu believes the real reason for the rollout was for Kenyatta and Ruto to announce their re-election campaign and to insulate them against potential problems in 2017.
You know, in Kenyan elections, there's always accusations of rigging. This was just for show, so that should some rigging occur in future, they can basically say, you saw our might by the number of people who crossed over.
Olu argues that many of the 11 parties were dormant parties that do not have any electoral representation, even at the county level. And he notes that none of the opposition parties joined Jubilee.
All these parties that purportedly are dissolving were already in a post-election coalition with the Jubilee government. You didn't hear ODM dissolving, you didn't hear Ford Kenya dissolving, you didn't hear Wiper dissolving, you didn't hear Amani National Congress dissolving.
Political writer Barack Muluka says if Kenyatta and Ruto truly want to unite Kenyans, they must make real changes in Kenyan society.
But they must make the next step, which is to bring the rest of the Kenyan ethnic groups together with them, and that they are not going to do through telling them that, come, let us be under one party. They are going to do that and achieve that through a sense of redressive and redistributive justice in economic and social development in the country, not just nominally having people under one political party umbrella.
The International Criminal Court previously charged Kenyatta and Ruto with involvement in Kenya's 2007 and 2008 post-election violence, in which more than 1,000 people were killed. Both cases were dismissed after prosecutors said the government interfered with efforts to collect evidence. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Italian Coast Guard says rescue vessels pulled more than 3,400 migrants and refugees from small rubber boats in the Mediterranean over the weekend. Italy has received more than 115,000 migrants and refugees in the first 7 months of this year. Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary predicts that if African migrations continue, high birth rates among Muslims mean, in his words, Europe will no longer be recognizable. Mr. Orban is one of the European Union's strongest critics of the way the EU has managed the two-year demographic crisis. While Hungary has sealed its borders with razor wire fencing, Germany has accepted an estimated 1 million migrants and refugees.
I can't speak for everyone, but I can assure you that we are.
Last week, Zimbabwe's High Court lifted a two-week police ban on protests imposed by the police. Security officials said they did not have the resources to contain potential violence that could be started by the protesters. Tendai Biti is a constitutional lawyer who led the fight to lift the ban. He also is a former finance minister and leader of the People's Democratic Party. Demonstrators complain about alleged corruption, high unemployment, and the decline of the economy. In part one of the two-part interview, reporter William Eagle asked Biti if the opposition plans to renew protests anytime soon.
I can't speak for everyone, but I can assure you that we are in a long winter of discontent. So these protests are coming, and they will continue.
President Mugabe has been quoted as saying that the judges are wrong and that they have a duty to be sure that protests will be peaceful before granting permission for a demonstration to take place. Is that the way you read the Constitution?
In Zimbabwe, just like in the United States of America, there is clear separation of power between the judiciary and the executive. So the president of Zimbabwe has no right at all to interfere or to insinuate or to emasculate the function of the courts and the independence of the court. This is fully enshrined in our constitution. And in the judgment that was handed down by the High Court fully asserted its independence in a clear, direct rebuke to the president's statement, and said we make our own decisions, and then proceeded to nullify the ban on demonstrations. So President Mugabe is old, he's frail, and he believes these people are his personal employees, but fortunately we have a constitution that guarantees separation of roles within the states and separation of powers, and fortunately, as is self-evident, we have judges that are prepared to stand up to a bully.
Mr. Biti, does the law require that the opposition get permission or register with a local or national official before a planned demonstration?
Before you want to demonstrate, you notify the police. That's what happens even in your country. In your country, you get a license. So that the law is similar in Zimbabwe and America on that point. The difference here is the power that is then given to the police of declaring a curfew or a de facto state of emergency. And that's what we took to court yesterday.
The law in Zimbabwe simply allow local authorities to say no each time you make a request for a protest.
Look, unlike in the United States of America, local authorities have no say in demonstrations and public meetings. It's only the police that can say yes or no to the holding of public demonstrations or processions or meetings.
Some say the opposition is fragmented and not capable of channeling the discontent with high unemployment and perceived corruption of the Mugabe administration. Is that the way you see the opposition?
Yeah, personally, I'm tired of this statement that says the opposition is fragmented. We have over 500,000 churches in Zimbabwe, and you don't hear anyone say the church is fragmented for the simple and good reason that it's not the number of opposition political parties that matters in Zimbabwe. It's what those opposition political parties are able to do. And quite evidently, if you look at what has been happening in the last two, 3 months, the opposition has been awakening. There is a new coalition called the Coalition for Democrats. There is another coalition of political parties called NERA, the National Agenda for Electoral Reform. So Zimbabweans are waking up and reorganizing themselves and occupying spaces that they were not occupying before. That's why the system is in a panic mode. That's why the regime is in a panic mode. And everyone knows in Zimbabwe that we are in a transition, a generational transition, a demographic transition, a political transition, an ideological transition. There's no question that we are moving away from an old order. The old order of a tired president who is 92 years of age and going to another a bus station. The only question is what kind of bus station will it be? So the question is about managing the transition. And that's what some of us are trying to do to ensure that the transition does not implode, the transition does not get arrested, the transition does not get hijacked, the transition does not get delayed, and the transition does not get captured, and the transition gets us to destination Zimbabwe, where we have a sustainable democratic republic.
That was Tendai Biti, a leader of the People's Democratic Party in Zimbabwe. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. Tomorrow, Biti talks about the changes technology is bringing to opposition tactics.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The death toll from the earthquake that shook Tanzania yesterday is now 16. And in Kenya, 11 political parties say they will merge with President Uhuru Kenyatta's Jubilee Party. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict warns that increasingly complex conflicts have a devastating impact on children. An annual report presented to the UN General Assembly shows that emerging crises and protracted conflicts profoundly disrupt children's lives in countries such as South Sudan, Syria, and Iraq in the same manner as other conflicts 20 years ago. The report shows Afghanistan recorded the highest number of child deaths and injuries last year. Leila Zarugi, the special representative of the Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict, also highlights accomplishments in the reduction of the numbers of children, child soldiers, and in holding countries accountable for their abuse of children. She spoke with me about the progress made since the UN appointment of a special representative on children and armed conflict.
When this mandate was created 20 years ago, it was because of the shocking image that starts receiving image through the television on children recruited by the LRA, recruited by armed groups and other parties involved in the war in Liberia, Sierra Leone. But today, the same image we are receiving also in other places and sometimes in the same place that were affected at the time. The difference is that in the past, nobody was really aware that children should not go through this. And nobody was considering that it's not acceptable what has happening to them. Today, I think after 20 years of advocacy, existence of this mandate, tools put in place by the General Assembly that decided to create this mandate that asked us to report to the General Assembly, to the Human Rights Council every year, then the Security Council that consider since 1999 that children affected by armed conflict is an issue that affect international peace and security.
Since the mandate has been put into place, then what progress has been made that you all can really concretely say has happened?
First of all, I think that today, if we see, for example, the first violation that was identified as unacceptable, affecting children, recruitment and use of children, because children recruited are killed, are maimed, are abused, etc. We have really made strong progress, particularly with government forces. Today, we have 7 government forces listed out of 193 countries. Out of many countries in conflict, we have 7 that still recruit children. Among these 7, we can say that at least 4 are making serious progress. And we are today, when we speak about recruitment and youth, nobody is questioning that this is not acceptable for children. This is a major progress, because if you just go back 10 years ago, I remember when I was in the field trying to convince parties and government forces to release children, they were like, it's not your business. Today, nobody can say it's not your business. Even those who still have the problem are trying to justify it or explaining that they have difficulties in controlling their troops, in assessing the age. They don't have age verification or they don't have birth registration. So I think this is a major progress. And I can say that even when it comes to fighting impunity, we have so many cases of governments that are arresting people that even within their own armed forces that recruit children.
What areas of focus will there be going ahead, looking into the future?
We are in a very difficult context today. We have so many conflicts. We have proliferation of parties that are involved. We have proxy wars. We have armed groups that have no interest in engaging with the international community or with the UN. You have this extreme violence committed by some armed group, Boko Haram, ISIL, and others. Children continue to be recruited, forcibly recruited also, by these groups and by others. So the challenge is there. Even when we succeed, for example, in the last 20 years, we have 115,000 children that have been released. It doesn't mean that all these children enjoy their lives, get their rights protected, return to school. So the reintegration of those who are released is a challenge still today and tomorrow, because we don't have enough infrastructure, people working on protecting children against gangs, against re-recruitment, against other abuses in the community.
Leila Zarugi is the special representative of the Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict. She spoke with me from New York.
Experts say since the terrorist attacks on the U.S. on September 11, 2001, U.S. defenses have hardened and America has become safer. But some say efforts to blunt radicalization within Islam has achieved little. Dr. Tawfiq Hamid is a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. He's an Islamic scholar and reformer from Egypt. He was previously a terrorist and a member of an Islamic organization with Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who later became al-Qaeda's second-in-command. On the 15th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of 9/11, Muhammad al-Shanawi asked him why Islamist violence is still growing despite counter-terrorism efforts.
You simply said it, the world counter-terrorism efforts. That is the problem that the world is facing, because it's trying in this way to treat terrorism, while the terrorism is just the final step in a process of radicalism. If we do not give the same attention that we give to counter-terrorism to the phenomenon of radicalism itself, which is an ideological phenomena, a gradual change in the nature of a person to make him more violent, having more hatred to the other, lack of acceptance to any other view or opinion. It's a very gradual process that leads to ultimately to terrorism. So if we do not give attention to treat the cause of the problem, which is radicalism, and focus on the symptom of the problem, which is radicalism first, then here's terrorism, then we are not going to treat any disease.
How do you explain the continuous ability of Islamist terrorist groups to remain active in launching more attacks everywhere?
Simply because these radical groups are very intelligent and they try to focus on how to get sources of money underneath their hands. If you still remember ISIS, when they starts to expand in Iraq area, they already got some banks and the gold and the money in these banks. You're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Then they managed to control some oil refineries, and through their connections, they managed actually to sell it to possibly some countries around them. Some people are saying the Turkish government used to take from them oil. So here you see a system with the ability to generate money, either by forcing the minorities sometimes to pay their money and their gold as what they consider as a tax that must be paid by the minorities. They go to banks and steal banks, and I can reassure you that they have no limitations in the sources of money. For example, they can allow opium trade and all illegal things to happen, especially with drugs, because they do not consider this un-Islamic. They consider alcohol un-Islamic, but for the other addictive drugs, they consider them okay. So the use of all these factors together to generate money is a critical factor that allows them to continue and be able to launch more attacks, plus the local support from people around them who are already infected with the same ideology, and that is another problem.
Why do Americans 15 years after 9/11 still feel that violent extremists can strike at homeland?
Because it is a reality. You see what happened in Europe, for example, how many attacks occurred in Europe. The concept is you deal with the Western nations, who are giving very high level of security and who are aware of the problem, yet they couldn't prevent major attacks on their land and repeatedly. So I think this is a major factor. When they see how Europe is doing in fighting it, they realize that they are in the same basket.
That was Tawfiq Hamid of the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhaib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Madu will discuss malaria research breakthroughs with her guest, Professor Kelly Shibali, researcher, University of Cape Town. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth one-on-one conversation with Namibian President. The wide-ranging discussion will include the President's vision for the future of the Southern African nation. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else, right here on VOA.